Episode 8. Goddy May. 1919. Mabel Parks, my other mother, who you know as Goddy May, is born in the lush, rural Mavis Bank area, the coffee farming lands below the Blue Mountains. Goddy May is the second of four known siblings. The oldest, and the only boy child, is Altmund, Uncle Alty. After Mabel comes Tatlis, Aunt Tat. I've heard stories of my Uncle Alty and Aunt Tat, but I never met them. Neither of them came to England. What I know about them could barely fill a thimble. The youngest of the four siblings is my mother, Esther. The fruity vegetable scent of coffee plants fills the Mavis Bank air. Way up yonder, in the cool stillness of the John Crow Mountains, lakes, ponds, pools overflow and trickle into the headwater of the Yalas River. The baby river traverses the Blue Mountains, winding, descending, joined by tributaries from the surrounding hillsides. Babbling and dancing, it passes Mabel's home and meanders through the fertile valleys along the border of St. Andrew and St. Thomas parishes. Picking up volume and speed, it rushes southwards to the sea. After school, Mabel will push through the thickets and scamper down to the shallow part of the river with her bucket, where the womenfolk squat, scrubbing clothes against the rocks. She'll join the other children, collecting wash water, splashing each other, gossiping, horsing around. A lot of mixed Chinese-Jamaican children went to her school, and many of their Chinese fathers had second families back home. The Chinese had such a monopoly on the grocery trade, Mabel's folks would simply say they were going to the Chinaman shop to refer to shopping for groceries and household goods. The shopkeepers were willing to sell on trust, which made them popular with the locals. Mabel is just sweet 16 when along comes Morris, the fruit of her loins, cousin Morris. In her day in Jamaica, having a child at that age, or even younger, was par for the course. And Morris's daddy has gone with the wind, absent without leave, leaving monoparent, baby mother Mabel to become yet another mode and median statistic of social surveys on parenthood.
A Parliamentary Royal Commission report of 1938 recommends that a campaign against the social, moral, and economic evils of promiscuity be organised. This leads to the government of Jamaica initiating a mass marriage movement, which successfully increases the marriage rate. But, for only a few years, the illegitimacy rate is soon back to previous levels.
It is the early 50s, and Mabel, now known as Goddy May, goes to the Carib Cinema in Kingston Town, where the audience would respectfully stand and sing, "God Save the Queen." The programme would contain pathy newsreels, extolling the virtues of the British Empire. The promise of greener grass and pleasant lands will convince her to give Great Britain a go. Over on the northern coast of Jamaica lies the wealthy tourist town of Ora Cabeça, bathed in apricot gold sunlight. Goddy May's young cousin, Sissy, has just been employed as a domestic at the surprisingly Spartan house, recently built nearby for a wealthy Englishman. Sissy says, "Mr. Englishman seems happy in his new home from home, confining himself to his study for days on end, avoiding all distractions, pecking away on his typewriter." She reckons, "Mr. Englishman has to be consuming at least 70 cigarettes a day, and countless bottles of alcohol."
His name is Ian Fleming, and he is finishing the novel Casino Royale at his holiday estate, Goldeneye. The setting and filming of his novel Dr. No in Jamaica will bring a wave of film tourism, a necessary evil, to the island. In Jamaica, he will write all his James Bond novels.
Goddy May at 40 has her photo taken for her 1960 passport, for her move to the motherland. The monochrome photo is oval-shaped, on a white background. She looks so much younger than her age. Her expression is frozen. She must be holding her breath, conscientiously following the photographer's instructions to look straight into the lens and not move. Her hair is sheeny shiny, hot iron straightened and curled with a parting on one side. She wears a pale-coloured shirt-style blouse, with the collar open to reveal her necklace, an unusual elaborate affair made of some sort of polished metal, probably silver, band of slender interlocking sections, and long lozenge-shaped pearls suspended from each of the sections. Although they're sisters, my mother and Goddy May address each other in a particularly old-school Jamaican way, as Miss Esther and as Mrs. Telfer. In England, despite living a short distance apart, the sisters rarely see each other. Because neither wishes to turn up empty-handed, they will only visit if they can first make the time to cook, in which case they will bring dishcloth-wrapped Tupperware tubs of tasty dishes, rice and peas, ackee and saltfish, oxtail stew, or they will arrive with plastic shopping bags bulging with random items. With these formalities out of the way, the catching-up session can commence. Regular topics will include Cousin Morris, what's he done now? My brother Stephen, in serious trouble yet again? Church gossip, how wicked this world has become, and so forth. Each time I visit Goddy May in the late 90s, she's weaker, frailer, smaller, diminishing. From one visit to the next, her hair has gone totally white. I tell her not to worry because it actually suits her. She laughs and says she knows she had been dyeing it for ages, but decided she could stop when it was evenly white all over. One dark afternoon in December 2004, while at work, I received the dreaded phone call. The one that was just a matter of time. The one that makes you want to take a few steps backwards. As though you could step back into the past that way. But no, Goddy May has gone. For her tombstone we inscribe the beginning of the Lord's Prayer.
Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil.
For thou art with me. After a short period of grieving, it suddenly occurs to me that I'm being selfish. Would I really want her to be still here in her broken body, suffering? No, far better for her to be free from pain. And so, I skip the intermediate stages of grief, I fast forward to acceptance, and from almost one moment to the next, I become happy, happy for Goddy May. Here, let me show you this photo of Goddy May. I took it when I visited her one lazy Sunday afternoon in 2003, the year before she passed away. It shows a corner of her council flat sitting room.
It is chock-a-block with random furniture, knick-knacks and bric-a-brac collected over the years.
And doilies, everywhere.
The place is coated in a warm Pantone pale tobacco tint from years of Marlboro and Pall Mall smoke.
Smoke from cigarettes she sometimes sweet-talked me into buying. Her diabetes and assorted ailments be damned.
The room is low-ceilinged, floral-carpeted and cosy. The wall with the window is cream, while the other is of imitation chalet panelling.
But what you can't see in the photo is a gas wall heater just out of view, softly hissing. Its heat beckons Sunday afternoon slumber.
In the background, a net curtain-veiled window, our photo's source of light. To the left of the frame, an open plywood trunk. Its padlock dangles. On top, a pile of vinyl records, some propped up and sleeveless.
Cousin Morris's lifelong collection. Now in his early 60s, Cousin Morris is living with his mother again. Beard a little greyer, but looking good for his age.
To the right of Morris's collection, a stern high-backed beige armchair, softened up by a red floral comfy cushion and colourful pieces of crochet. And to the right of that, a small square stocky coffee table with a packet of cigarettes in easy reach. Behind this, tucked into the corner, a wooden cabinet, shaped a little like the front of a boat, full of crockery and glasses. Atop, sundry ornaments, including a glazed plaster fruit pyramid sitting on pale pink and blue crinoline. Next to the cabinet, the mantelpiece, covered in French lace, laden with more ornaments.
And there is Goddy May, in all her splendour.
She is seated in the foreground, to the right, facing inward. Dressed in acrylic beige nightdress under a dark blue,
midnight blue,
quilted housecoat.
With huge bright flowers.
Hands clasped on her lap, she looks at the camera, through oversized glasses.
She's plumper now. Her bemused half-smile ever more immortalised.
Her white hair is neatly plaited. Behind her, on the back of the chair, a Father Christmas towel.
The rosy-cheeked Santa is smiling at us too. Outside the frame, the clock on the wall that can neither be seen nor heard is ticking her time away. What's the time, Mr. Wolf? On what I feared could be my last visit, to see Goddy May, I asked her about my father. I'd always assumed, hoped, she could fill me in on a detail or two about him. But it turns out she wasn't around at that time. She was living in another town, and travelling in Jamaica was so bad at the time that she may as well have been in another country. This also means she knows nothing of my sister Vera's father, nor of her childhood in Jamaica. That comes as a blow. It's rather like having kept a sealed envelope forever, and finally opening it, to find it was empty, all that time.